Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Wilfred Chow. Wilfred is an assistant professor in the School of International Studies.
His research interests include international relations, political economy, public opinion, and methodology. His publications explore the role of the mass public in international relations by drawing from a diverse set of fields such as comparative authoritarianism, identity politics, and political communication.
In 2024, together with Dr. Dov H. Levin from the University of Hong Kong, Wilfred published the article, The Diplomacy of Whataboutism and U.S. Foreign Policy Attitudes in the Journal of International Organization. So the first thing that kind of pulled me towards this paper, Derek, is that wonderful term, whataboutism, which sounds like something my mother would say to me when she's chastising me, basically.
Well, I know she would say it.
What about that?
My mother.
Would she also say, what about this? What about that?
I'm just joking.
Don't.
What about it? It seems in some ways like a very childish term.
It does. And that was what kind of first sort of made me take an interest in this paper was that term. Because I hadn't heard of that before. And as you say, it felt quite childish. But actually, it's a very real term in international relations, isn't it?
But also kind of childish in its application in a way.
International relations is basically quite childish.
I did not say that, but it did strike me that this particular phenomenon certainly seemed to be, and I think that there's good reason for that, which I saw Wilfred kind of nodding over there saying, okay, yeah.
Well, some of the examples that Wilfred and his collaborators use do seem very childish. You know, they seem like sort of playground school kind of ant.
I was just thinking of this whole, remember Trump's debates when he was saying, I'm not a puppet, you're the puppet.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the phenomenon. Like at the first, I was trying to formulate it as he did this, but they did that. But it's actually not that phenomenon as such. It's a bit more specific than that. Mm. But what we should probably do is get the expert to explain it instead of me babbling on about it.
You're babbling again.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Such a babbler. Okay, welcome, Wilfred. Thank you for coming here today and sharing your research with us. Could you please give us an overview, an introduction to the paper here for our listeners?
Well, thank you, Mary and Derek, for inviting me over. So at first glance, it does appear a bit childish. It's a little bit of name calling, seems like schoolyard antics. And I think that's kind of where it starts, but it actually has a deeper philosophical origin. So the basic argument is very straightforward. You have somebody accusing someone of some sort of misdeed. It could be the US, it could be an NGO. And then the target of the misdeed flips it around and says, well, what about this situation? What about that time you did such and such? And the question, of course, is then, does that antic actually work? So from an outside observer, you might think, well, it seems a bit silly. It doesn't seem to matter a whole lot. And that's where we started to get interested in the idea is that if it's so silly, why are so many important actors persistently and frequently engaging in it? Because then it would just be silly to just do something that seems basically insane and ineffective. But we have to actually test this out. Now, you can't look at the document, just analyze it, because that's not valuable. You want to think about who the audience in question is. And we started by looking into public audiences. So we first started in the United States, where the What About is a paper, an international organization, comes from. And we had a basic scenario where we set up two situations common in foreign policy. You had a national security issue, where the United States would accuse another country of meddling in their domestic politics. And another situation was just a refugee crisis, where the United States would accuse another country of violating basic human rights. And then we started to vary the scenarios a little bit. We said, well, does it matter who the target is? Is it an ally like Germany? Is it an enemy like Russia. So we did have ways to address it. So we usually pretest this by simply asking, what is your opinion of this country? And so we just have a favorability metric.
Can I interject there? Because when you're referring to that, measuring it, you are measuring how effective this is and how effective it is at doing what exactly?
Well, so in terms of effectiveness, what we're actually measuring is public support and approval for the policy and their approval for punishment. And of course, this goes into a broad literature. Does the public actually matter? And I think we've come to realize that if you get public support, it gives you more freedom of action as a policymaker. That's true whether you're in the US, the UK, even China and Russia. They do care about this. They pay attention to it to a certain degree. So to a certain extent, I mean, this is really the big issue about the measurement. Now, people do think it shouldn't matter in the sense that they don't think the public responds to these messages. So one of the nice things about an experimental design structure is you can compress a median environment into specific scenarios and see how they respond. And usually studies have shown that if you can match the hypothetical to the real situation, they've come like cross-correlation analysis, you get fairly consistent responses to how they would behave in reality.
This was the bit that interested me a lot, because you started to go into the actual experimental design here and the methodology that was used and how you gathered this data. And for a concept that in many ways is quite simple, you know, we're talking about it in playground terms, actually, this was incredibly complex, the actual methodology and the gathering and the analyzing of data. This was the bit in the paper that I struggled with the most, I have to say.
Well, I was really impressed by it, I have to admit, because the way that these variables were able to be explored, of course, there's a few more that I twigged onto that I will ask about, but maybe you can explain to the listeners how you kind of chose the variables and then what you did in order to test for them.
Oh, great question. So the basic structure that you really want to do with any type of experimental survey is you want to mimic reality, but you also want to make sure that it's some more hypothetical in the future. So this is all set up somewhere in like 2029, 2028. And the motivation for it comes twofold. If you want to make it real, the first standard in any experiment is you have to be comparing apples to apples. So you have to make sure that the event happened in one area and that all of the potential treatments you impose could actually occur. So as an illustration, one of our scenarios involves a refugee crisis. And so this has to be a refugee crisis in Europe. And so there is a historical precedent with, you know, Syrian refugees, people coming in, and then which borders are most likely to be impacted. So that's where we have to look at the constraints imposed on us. We want a friendly, we want a sort of a contentious country, we want a neutral country. So Russia, Turkey, Germany, those are all potential refugee zones that are realistic enough where anyone reading it wouldn't just immediately dismiss it. Because the danger that you have with any type of hypothetical scenario is if we just start saying something random and say aliens, then the respondent will simply dismiss it. You can't take their responses seriously anymore. Hence, it has no policy value. So that's where the initial scenario is constructed. Then after that, it's actually pretty straightforward. Some people see one scenario, others see another, and you just ask them a basic question. Do you approve of this policy from the administration? If the administration decided to impose sanctions, would you support it? And then we just ask them a basic five-point measure. They call it a Likert measure, how strongly you support to how strongly you disagree. So that's the basics. And then from then on, it's actually pretty straightforward. You just construct a percentage. 25% approval versus 55% approval. That's actually, I think, the easiest part. Then, of course, the bigger questions come in. How is this happening? So there's a couple of techniques later on in the paper where we use causal mediation analysis to figure out what's the actual mechanism. Is it impacting moral equivalence in terms of how they see U.S. leadership versus, say, broader U.S. global legitimacy? And then one of the techniques that we particularly like, which I think is easier for most people to digest, is we just ask the respondents, give us a sentence to explain why you picked what you picked. So then you can actually use a type of machine learning using structural topic analysis to classify the topics. So from there, you're letting the respondents give you their words as to why they did it. And that's where it becomes really valuable, because then you start seeing words like, the US is such a hypocrite. You know, this is the pot calling the kettle black, which I was a little bit surprised that Americans actually ended up using that phrase, but It is there. And so I think that illustrates the sort of justification of what the actual respondents are thinking. And then you get a better sense of how their logical thinking process is going on in terms of the actual experiment imposed on them.
The other variables that you're inserting, so it's not just the country that's doing this, right? It's kind of their strategy in how they what about, right?
Yeah. So this has to do with basic diplomatic communication strategies. So the baseline control that we have is where the target country that's being criticized has no response. And from there, we originally just set up a basic set of standards that we kind of found both in the legal and philosophy literature, where one is how relevant is the counter-criticism? So there's one thing of saying, well, this is a bad person versus this is the specific act that's similar. So here we looked at similarity of action. And so in one of our scenarios, if they criticize about human rights violations on refugees, they might fire back and said, well, you guys did an internment of Japanese prior to the Second World War. Now, it's a bad act, but it's not very relevant. It's also deep in the past. The other thing that we tried to pick up was maybe it has to do with just pure timelines, meaning how frequent or how recent the action is. So the equivalent in the U.S. case is their treatment of migrants by the U.S.-Mexican border recently. But you could go back further into history and look at U.S. treatment of refugees more broadly. And that could also be a way of counter-criticizing. And what we usually find is the closer and more relevant the actual criticism of what about its action is where you get the largest purchase. So that was the original set of treatments. And then we presented this, I think, at George Washington University. We had a couple of national security people come back, and they didn't believe our results. They said, no. And we said, well, what's the problem? They said, you didn't give the American government a chance to respond to the criticism. I was a bit skeptical that that would work, but I was like, fine, we'll do this again. So our first survey we ran, I think, early 2022, then we ran it again sometime about late 22, maybe October of 2022 after that workshop. So we replicated our results, and then we had a U.S. government response. One of them is actually pretty common. This is what the Biden administration did when Russia recently accused them of some sort of misdeed. They just dismissed it. Like, this is irrelevant. They're not paying attention. So that was one of our treatments. It's easy. Another of our treatments was more of a contextual factor. This is where we got motivated from previously Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, where they accused the U.S. of something. And he said, you know what? In the history of the United States, we have accepted more refugees than anyone in the entire world. And he just went on and on and on. That's a good way, because we know the State Department would never outright apologize. And then the last one, they do have this type of strategy. It's the slang is pulling a mulligan, where he said, okay, so we've done these bad things. We're not going to admit we did this, but we'll say that U.S. behavior has changed. We're going to do better. And so then we looked at these different ranges, and none of them worked. They barely worked with the we'll do better, but it wasn't really effective. So basically, when the U.S. is caught with hypocrisy in their face, counter responses are not really effective.
This sounds like some pretty high-level impact research if you have kind of all these responses coming from quite key government departments and political actors. Looking at this, I'm amazed that there are only two authors on this paper, because it seems like an enormous project, actually. How long did it take you to gather, to design this and gather all of this data?
Well, the great thing about experiments is they've democratized. So the hard part is the front end matter before actually running the experiment. So we have to do a pretest. We have to make sure everything's worked out. But once that's figured out, you can basically hire a company, get a relatively representative national sample in about 3-4 days. And then the rest is just analysis. And of course, you have to spend a lot of money. So there's that. So once you get all that down. So, I mean, this is like the first of many projects. So since you brought up the issue about people caring about it, that's where our foreign affairs piece came in. Because after we published International Organizations, Foreign Affairs, which is the flagship journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, that typically talked to U.S. policymakers. Mm-hmm. They wrote to us and they said they would like to invite us for an article. And they still will determine whether they ultimately will publish it. So then we did a short form version of that. And then we also included our new results, where we fielded the survey in Japan and the United Kingdom and found basically identical results.
Because that was actually going to be my next question, was that everything you talked about and all of the data and the examples, this is very US-centric, it's very American-centric. So to what extent is this transferable to different scenarios around the world?
And that's a great question. So that was something that people were curious about. So then we did the same thing. We picked exactly the same scenario, except the way we tweaked it is we then asked, what about your support for your government support for the U.S. government? Do you approve of your government standing by the U.S. government? Do you support your government joining in American sanctions? And I think this has very strong policy relevance. And we found a fairly similar effect. The broad effect is every time you see a very powerful, relevant whataboutism, it reduces public support wherever the baseline is by 17 points. It's a 70 percentage point drop. And what was kind of funny is before we ran the UK survey, my co-author wrote to me and said, because it was around December of 2022, I was still tweaking it. And he's like, we need to rush this. And I said, why? He's like, I think Russia's going to invade Ukraine.
Goodness me.
So it was like 2021. And then in January of 2022 is when we fielded the UK survey. And it's true, Russia did it a month later, but we got the results. And the real fear was that if Russia had invaded Ukraine and then there was so much public antipathy toward there, we weren't sure if we could get a fair reading of Russia anymore. You know, they would just be just evil incarnate at that point.
I hate it when international politics gets in the way of your research like that.
International politics. So an interesting question to me looking at this, because I've done some work on logical fallacies and things like that, but more for student writing than this level. But you list this whataboutism as a kind of fallacy, and then you link it to a long history of actually, you go back to the Bible, don't you, when you're talking about he who is without sin should cast
the
first stone. Yeah. And you differentiate the whataboutism from a name and shame game, right? So can you kind of walk us through the differences here and what makes this unique?
Absolutely. So the name and shame literature is much older than what we do in terms of diplomatic communication. It comes out of a research in international relations where you typically have a non-government organization. You could think of, say, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and then they're going to look at countries that have a stated value. This is typically going to be the United States. And then they're going to accuse this country of not upholding their values. So maybe they need to criticize another state and so forth. And so the U.S. could also do another thing where they could also accuse another country of the same thing. The most recent example I can think of is where France accused Italy of mistreating refugees. So this is like a first attempt to name and shame them. So Italians can't say, well, and that's just how we treat refugees, because that goes against their stated values as a democratic state. So that's the name and shame. You're trying to publicly shame them into better behavior. But this is a first mover advantage. Now, whataboutism takes that idea and says, well, you've been shamed already. What do you do about it? And this is where you respond. And that's where we're looking at is this particular tit for tat. How does it affect public opinion?
And it's attacking the accuser, though. Right?
Yes.
So you can't just whataboutism towards someone else, because that's a deflection, right?
Yes. So at that point, that probably would be a shaming. If you're the one starting it off, it would be shaming. Versus actually
or versus saying, you know, if I accuse you of something and you say, okay, well, maybe I do, but so does X. It's not doing the same as attacking the accuser. It's just trying to normalize the behaviors.
That's a good thing. So we didn't want to do something which tried to speak to a broader image. So I think this might be a good point to describe what's happening. So the initial logic of whataboutism follows under a more of a legal type structure. So much of the research that we found is the classic example. You put like a expert witness on the stand, right? So what the opposing lawyer would want to do is undermine their expertise. What you're trying to do is undermine what makes their particular testimony valuable. So in this case, what you're trying to do is undermine the legitimacy, the credibility of the accuser. So trying to accuse an outside third party wouldn't be valuable in that case.
Going into the history about this, I was fascinated to read that the hasn't actually been a lot of literature written on this. And it seems to be quite a sort of obvious kind of turn. But you clearly identify in your paper that there has been a gap in your field in international relations. Why do you think that is? Why has this not been something that has been done before, that has been picked up? Because it does seem, in the way that you're describing it, to be something that is highly significant and also very old. You know, you go back to things like using the examples of the Nuremberg trials of Germany, and then you talk also, Quigley goes far back as the Old Testament, as you state as well. So why was this such a gap, do you think, in the literature? Why had it not been so addressed?
I think it's for two reasons. The first one is the one that both of you started with, is it does seem a bit silly. So people, when they're initially encountering it, just don't think it's really valuable, or they don't think it works. And so we had to first demonstrate that. I think the second thing is a little bit more fundamental. It's because the people that thought about whataboutism were treating it as a type of ad hominem attack, a logical fallacy. And it's changing recently in the philosophy field. Like, as of just a couple months ago, you're starting to see publications in there where they're realizing it is a distinct type of tactic that is different from just shaming someone or undermining their legitimacy.
So calling them names, which is what...
Yeah, so they're just like name calling or just mocking them. So one of the things that I've seen, and this is something I've seen from Aiken's work, who's a philosopher from University of Nashville, is he calls it a type of evidentiary expansion. So one of the things about international relations is when people use a term like international law, it's fairly ambiguous. The average respondent isn't really sure where to place them. So when you accuse someone, you're claiming some sort of higher moral authority that this is the law. Well, what the accused is actually responding with is not just trying to undermine your credibility. They're actually telling you, well, is that true? So to give you an example, when Belarus basically downed Ryanair and grabbed a political dissident, you had the Western media accuse it of all this type of violation of human rights. And the Russians were like, well, you tried to do that with Edward Snowden, and you tried to do this, and you invoked the same rule. So what they're pointing out to you is this actually a violation of international law? So this way, they're actually expanding the burden of proof as to whether or not this is a correct evaluation of a immoral act.
Mm-hmm. You state at one point, one of your kind of arguments in the paper is that this whataboutist rhetoric, when it is deployed internationally, actually undermines public support at home for a government's criticism of other countries' bad behavior. So it is actually sort of working against itself. Can you explain that?
So one of the things that would happen is that if you do not see the other side use a type of whataboutist tactic, let's say they're completely silent. They say they deny it. They just don't pay attention to you. You can get a lot of public support for whatever policy you're interested in. So typically it ranges between 50 to 60%. So you're getting the majority of the country to support you. It could be a criticism against Myanmar, Russia, what have you. But if that country were to use whataboutism and expose you for the hypocrisy of your actions, then you end up with a significant drop, so you shouldn't have done it in the first place. So this is actually the challenge. And so the way where we're going with that is we're actually analyzing whether or not governments should be accusing others in the first place. So we're basically combining the name and shame and the whataboutism element. So in terms of preliminary test, I think the American government is in a very hard position. They can't be silent. The worst thing they can do is to not say anything, because then they are accused of being immoral, and that's a bipartisan effect in the United States. But then, if they use whataboutism, they also get hurt, but not as badly. So they end up in a situation, if they were truly in a legitimately moral position to accuse others, that's great. That's the best of all worlds. If they're silent, that's the worst. Hypocrisy is somewhere in the middle.
Is this a tactic that we talked previously about, the sort of the American-centric sort of nature of your study? Is this a tactic that is often, say, more appropriate to or more limited to, say, globally dominant countries and sort of world powers in this way? I mean, or is this a tactic that we see at kind of all levels?
So I think that's a good point. So the reason we went with the US and other major powers is they tend to be politically salient. But this is employed at so many levels at it doesn't really have to have major powers involved. So I mentioned the case of France and Italy. They have both accused each other of horrible things they have each done to refugees at different points. And so this is pretty common. And you see this also employed in Europe with the Hungarians versus the EU. And it's just a very common tactic. Now, the reason why we don't necessarily run surveys in those countries is when you do, someone would come back to you and say, well, it's just not really an important country. So then if you do the US, like, well, wow, this is America.
Oh, that's kind of sad in a way.
No, this is absolutely true in the review process.
Right.
but also in the measurement process and all sorts of other areas, I would assume. I was actually really fascinated by the public opinion element here as well. I underlined one section here where you had pointed out that, you know, recent survey experiments show that providing accurate information to Americans about the U.S. government's foreign policy, such as the true size of its foreign aid budget, or of common international norms and practices, such as international laws relevant to certain U.S. foreign activities, significantly impacts public attitudes. And I don't know, I just found that really both blatantly obvious, like if you're told the truth, maybe you should think about it and react to it, but also that it needed to be said, I found quite interesting. Mm. So, you know, the idea of public opinion, how much is it usually swayed by mistruths, half-truths, or these kind of rhetorical...
increasingly relevant questions today.
Well, yeah, the kind of post-truth era, I suppose, which I hate the term, but it's unfortunately accurate in some cases.
So public opinion is one of the more difficult ways to measure, because a lot of the things you brought up are actually occurring simultaneously. So from the public's standpoint, there could be certain ideological values that you have. So there's quite a lot of stuff done in the immigration literature. My favorite is a paper where the authors had been doing survey experiments for, I think they did 8 survey experiments in a 6-year period, and they kept getting null results, meaning they couldn't get the public to change their opinion, because what they were designing was a misinformation model. They're saying, well, what if you tell them the truth about immigration? Will they change their opinion? It turns out they get an accurate opinion of immigration and they still won't change their opinion, whether they like it or dislike it. So there are certain issues. I think if the stakes are really high and the public themselves have certain value orientations, I don't think it's misinformation. It's just motivated reasoning on the part of the individual.
Or trying to argue someone out of a preconceived notion.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
It's almost impossible. Mm.
So then you have issues where they might not feel strongly about. So issues like foreign aid, they don't have such a strong opinion about it, but they might not be aware of it. So they're rationally ignorant. So then when you give them information on that, they may be less willing to support certain positions. And that's where you find out their willingness to kind of shift on those lines.
And you had pointed out as well in the article that at the extreme end, I suppose, public opinion can lead to either quiet disobedience if they aren't convinced by a certain position, or even greater results. And I was struck again in our contemporary world, we're looking at some very bizarre situations, I think. And what do you do with a regime that just doesn't care? You know, if public opinion doesn't seem to affect that what they want to do as policies or anything like that?
Well, the simple answer is eventually that regime changes.
Right.
And that's actually happening quite frequently. So as an example, I mean, you can just dismiss even the authoritarian regimes at the moment. Take a look at Europe. There are a strong group inside Europe, take Germany, for example, that are unhappy with the direction of where the country is going. And part of that has to do with their foreign policy position with Europe, the position with Russia, that's tied to living standards, inflation. And so you see a far right group like the AfD gaining traction. They're doing better than ever before.
Well funded as well.
Everybody is well funded. But that's the thing, is that even if we take all those things into account, what's actually happening is you're looking at a change in the government. Authoritarian regimes are a little bit different in the sense that it's a little bit more explosive. It doesn't happen in the electoral box. You see massive protest, and then something happens.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Wilfred, how exactly did your interest in this topic come about? Because this seems to be a huge sort of, undertaking, this research project. Was it something that came out of your PhD research? Is it post-PhD? How exactly did you and your collaborator become interested in conducting this?
We don't have anything fancy in terms of how we came to it. Two of our best papers came because we're having coffee and we're thinking, this is just so silly. This can't possibly be true.
Everything in academia comes out of coffee.
Sometimes why?
Yeah. So we're just having coffee and then we saw this recent article in the New York Times talking about Trump using a type of whataboutism on the domestic level. Well, this is pretty common in international relations. So we started looking into it and we thought, oh yeah, it is a thing. And we started looking at how frequent it occurs. And we even talked to some scholars in the field. And what we found striking to us is if you talk to policymakers, you look at journalists, they take this very seriously. Mm-hmm. Scholars didn't. They just could not believe this was a serious thing because they're like, this is silly. This is just pure rhetoric. It's
really interesting gap, disjunction there.
I know you are, but what am I? You can't study that.
Well, I think it just comes down to there is often a gap in international relations between the theorists and the policymakers. And over time, that gap closes as they start to realize certain things. But it does take a while for either side to figure out what's actually important to them. Well, I would imagine the policymakers have an advantage because what they're doing affects the real world.
One question as well. I was really fascinated by the study design and the positioning of it. And it seems to bridge a kind of governmental position directly with the public in a way. But normally this would be mediated by media, right? So what is the role of the media and then perhaps the erosion of trust in media in the effectiveness of these rhetorical efforts?
So this was something that our reviewers brought up quite a lot. So we had to explain some of the limitations of our study. By design, we are compressing media environments because in reality, people are exposed to different medias. They self-select what they choose to consume. Plus, we have that nasty algorithm that comes from the internet and social media. So what we're doing is we're saying, let's compress all of that. What if they were to see this information? And we wanted to avoid any of this misinformation stuff. So everything we had in there, we put in, say, this had third-party verification. And this was by design, because if you actually look at a lot of whataboutist statements, countries do invoke authority. The Russians will mention elements of the UN Charter. When China wants to counter-accuse the United States, they have an extensive body of evidence that they refer to. So this is a very real thing where they want to make sure they are not making things up. So there's that element. We also tested it by just removing it in our pretest. And we find that even if you remove it, the rhetoric itself makes people think about is they're using their information. So there are some of these elements. The last thing we did is prior to even running the survey, we were testing media reporting. So we changed the source in there. We said the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Russia Today, Global Times. They had a slight movement, but it didn't actually change what people thought. I think what's kind of confusing is that people take the facts as given. They are aware of the bias in the sources, but it's how they're actually presented. So I think this is actually happening on a real level. So we were not too concerned about some of it after looking at the results, whether we're looking at a government official. And to be fair, the person responding in all these things is an official member of that government. So you would imagine if they're going to discount it, if it's like the Russian Foreign Affairs Ministry, you would discount it because you might not trust Russia or Putin, but they still responded.
So in some ways, that's the strength of that nasty algorithm that you just mentioned, is that a lot of people wouldn't would see everything they're given as kind of transparent in terms of sourcing and then opaque in terms of origin.
They could do that. I think the real danger with the algorithm is not being exposed to the information at all.
Right.
But to be fair, I don't think that's as big a problem as people put it out to be. I mean, that is the general fear with the US government and banning TikTok. But I think you have to have a little bit of trust in the public. By that, I mean, at some point, they're going to stop accepting what's being given to them and start to find alternative sources. So while it is true the algorithm might take a series of toxic information, they're going to look for it. So as an example, when the US government started banning Russian news media, same with Europe, for better or for worse, a lot of people in the US and in Europe, they started entering into underground sites. They started looking for alternative media. So I think banning is not a good idea because they're going to look for it. And that's where social media allows them to do so. Like Russia has their own version of social media. If you don't want to go on YouTube, there's Rumble. So I think this is one of those concerns where, unlike the past where you could actually control information through national media, mainstream media, it's a lot harder in this environment.
And just to be clear, I wasn't talking about banning anything.
Oh, I know.
It was just, I find this really fascinating because, you know, the creation of echo chambers and things like that are really interesting, but not directly relevant necessarily. So,
yeah, it's all relevant.
Wilfred, you talked a little bit about the reception of the paper before, particularly among kind of sort of US intelligence and how they responded to this and how they were quite dismissive quite quickly, and also how you countered that. After the publication of the research in the very sort of prominent journal there, has there been any kind of wider response to it, any criticism, for instance?
No, I think maybe they just accept it and they just move on. So when we published our piece in Foreign Affairs, I mean, the neat thing was we were, for at least a week, the second most read article. And for a brief moment, we actually beat Condoleezza Rice, former national.
Congratulations.
For a week.
The person UNNC, that, get in there.
Yeah. So the person on top of us was a very prominent scholar writing about Ukrainian tactics on Russia at that moment. And so it was exciting. But I think the general element to this is that those people that don't like it simply dismiss it. Those people that appreciate it will have their own reasoning. So my co-author, for instance, went on a talk and reasoned with basically a libertarian podcast. And he wanted to talk about electoral interventions, but then the podcaster found out about this paper, and that's all he wanted to talk about. And he wanted to ask him, say, well, does this mean the US shouldn't go around intervening everywhere? And that's not actually what our paper says. It's beyond the scope, so we had to explain that. But I think what that suggests is there are camps in any foreign policy sphere. Those that do not want increased intervention are going to love this paper. Those that want to increase intervention are just going to dismiss the paper. So I think that's probably what's happening.
What conversation would you hope that this paper starts?
Well, I think the most valuable thing about this paper is it answers a question brought forth by a very famous constructivist scholar, Martha Fenimore. She is from the name and shame literature, and she asked a very simple question: what's the cost of hypocrisy? So she would give an example. So the US violated sovereignty by invading Iraq. And she didn't really have any metrics. So she would just say, well, that's probably not as bad as, and then she's starting to make these adjustments. And she's famous for saying that hypocrisy is the fuel of US foreign power. So at the end of the day, what our valuable element to this paper is to say, well, here's the actual public cost to any commander in chief in the United States.
So maybe act ethically to begin with?
Yeah, that's hard to do, but yes, that is actually the thing. Act ethically as much as possible.
Then you can take a moral high ground, and then you can't get what about it. Wilfred, thanks so much. What comes next? What can we expect to see from you in the near future?
What are your plans?
Well, the plan is to extend this paper to the name and shame literature. So we're really going to answer the question, what pressures did the US government face in terms of, do they actually want to be criticizing? Can they avoid not criticizing? And this is entering into a field I think people are realizing about American foreign policy, which is that you end up with an executive that picks positions of foreign policies that most of the public don't like, but that is a way of actually expressing strength. Because this ends up with a very hawkish bend. This is something that people have started to figure out experimentally, is you can give them a laundry list, foreign policy positions, all of them out of sync with what the public wants. And if you ask them, is this a good leader? They're like, heck yeah, he bombed somebody. And it's a very, very problematic situation. And so this is recently published. And so we're looking into that. In our research, we've done some pretest, does speak to this. It affects directly presidential leadership metrics, things like leadership strength, compassion. Does this leader care about me? All these metrics are related to how they're actually performing in terms of accusing someone. And the take-home point we have so far is, it's kind of unfortunate. It's better to be a hypocrite than to be perceived as immoral. Mm-hmm. So.
Might benefit us all to do some introspection on how we choose our leaders and why. But Wilfred, thanks so much. This was fascinating. I learned a lot today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Wilfred. And we wish you all the best in your future research.
Thank you for the invitation. It was fantastic.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.